Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman. My guest today is April Mays, author of The Mulatto Republic, Class, Race, and Dominican National Identity, published by the University Press of Florida in 2014. This book challenges the received wisdom about anti-Haitianism as one of the prevailing determinants of Dominican racial identities. It is so meticulously researched and crafted, zooming in on a small place as a way of getting at some big and important questions. Here's our conversation. I hope you enjoy it. April, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Alejandra. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So let's start out talking a little bit about your own trajectory. How did you get to be a historian?
My goodness, I just loved history. And I went to graduate school with the weird notion that I was there because I loved history. I didn't really understand it as a process of professionalization and becoming a professional historian. So I was a history buff in high school. And then I went to college, majored in history, and was encouraged by my mentors at Pomona College to consider pursuing a graduate degree in history. And I applied, and that's it. Then I decided to go. It was great.
So when did you first understand the question of race in the Dominican Republic to be your topic?
Oh, that's a good question too. You know, I would say there are sort of two trajectories. One is sort of the personal story of that, and then the other is the graduate story of that. So I think the personal story is coming of age with extended family there, and as my own kind of sense of identity and questions about race sort of fluctuated and changed as I grew older, and I realized there was this sort of, you know, conflict or choque between what I was sort of experiencing and how I wanted to embrace particular kinds of identity, like as a Black woman. And college was a really important time for me to come into feminism and Black feminism in particular. And that just didn't jive with a lot of my family members in the U.S. even too. So not just in the Dominican Republic. And so I realized, why is there this division and how can I sort of navigate that? And then in graduate school, it seemed like the place where we most often talked about race or Blackness, you know, was in the Caribbean or in Brazil. It seemed like we could talk about Mexico, we could talk about mainland Latin America, and never touch on the topic of African descendants. I mean, that's much different now, I think, in 2017 than it was in the 1990s, but certainly then. And so I realized, well, okay, if I'm going to be a Caribbeanist and focus on the Spanish-speaking Caribbean, you know, race is a question that looms large here. But I decided to focus on the Dominican Republic as opposed to Cuba or Puerto Rico, which at the time, Dominican history and Dominican studies was really still embryonic. It has been much more developed since my own time in graduate school. So I just sort of put those two things together, that one, you know, this was a space where these questions were really rich and engaging and, you know, important. And at the same time, the sort of lived experience and questions that I had that were coming to my head as I was growing older and becoming my own person. So the blending of those two trajectories really kind of shaped my whole question about how to approach the topic.
So I want to get in closer to your argument as you develop it in subsequent chapters. But in the introduction, you make it pretty clear that you're pushing back against the interpretation of Dominican racial ideologies as only anti-Haitian. So how did you arrive at that as your central question?
Oh, gosh, that's a really good question. It took a while, actually, and it wasn't even the question of that motivated my dissertation. This was very much a question that developed as I revised from the dissertation into the book. And I guess I finally came to that out of a sense of frustration, because as I kept reading the literature, it seemed like the only possible national narrative to come out of the Dominican Republic were racist ones. All national narratives and nationalisms are racial and racialized. They're not necessarily racist, right? I mean, we get into xenophobia and exclusion, obviously, when we talk about the creation of the nation and who's in and who's out. But I was sort of frustrated by what I felt was a lack of any role models. You know, as I think I make I raise this question in my book when I say something like, if we can't look to our own, if we can't look to our own Caribbean intellectual tradition for some of the answers to some of these questions, then I don't know where else we can look. And so I was trying to find in our own intellectual traditions hopeful narratives that might get us out of some of the conundrums around race and nation. So that's why it was important for me to say, okay, sure, there are limitations and problems, and certainly errors in some of the ways that some of these thinkers like Bonneau or like Gregorio Luperón answered these questions. But it's important that we really take into consideration what they're trying to do in their historical context, and not just throw them out and say, well, they're just all anti-Haitian and anti-Black because they're Hispanicist, or because they forward this kind of notion of mulataje, that therefore it's anti everything else. I was really just trying to suggest maybe we can go back to our own history to find some good examples and some interesting viewpoints that might help us in our contemporary context and into the future.
So place is really important, and the book is largely set in San Pedro de Macorís. Why there, and why did you choose to set it in a small place?
Because I actually, my dissertation was probably the last in this generation, right, of enclave histories. I came, into graduate school at a time when the enclave was still this important conceptual topic within Latin American historiography, particularly in the Caribbean and the Caribbean rimland. So I think more often when we think of enclave economies, we think of Central America, or we think of even Venezuela, like the oil camps or what have you. So I began there wondering to what extent San Pedro was this sort of exhibited characteristics that we see in other kind of enclave economies, and wrote a dissertation in that mode. And then when I, revised it for the book, I decided to stay in San Pedro as opposed to, shifting it to other places, because I realized there, if it wasn't a perfect enclave economy, it definitely was this very important transit point where a lot of different kinds of people were coming together. And if any place where the question of Blackness and foreignness and would come up, it would be San Pedro. And interestingly enough, that question wasn't always attached to Haitians. That question, was going to be attached to Afro-Antillean, English-speaking Afro-Antillean workers and what have you. It was not going to be just simply Black attached to Haitian. So I felt like San Pedro gave me an opportunity to do something a little bit different than other locations in the country.
So you start out by tracing some 19th century racial ideologies, and you mentioned already Pedro Francisco Bono, but also some others. And you argue that they offer a possibility of undoing the notion of anti-Black Hispanic nationalism. Can you talk about that a little bit more and tell us how you got there and what are they doing, these ideologists?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's important to really, when we talk about the 19th century nationalists, to understand just the very, very much so contested and hostile environment in which they're trying to make a case for the nation, and any nation, but a Dominican nation in particular, that is a place where there's clearly a lot of racial mixture, where there's African ancestry next door to Haiti, which has its own complicated, you know, history with the rest of the empires and the United States and France. And so in that, in light of that, so the first, I think my first case was to say, can we just have a little bit more empathy and listen a little bit closer to what they're saying and what and look at what they're doing, but also remembering the very hostile environment that this is unfolding. And so I think there's something I talk about in that chapter. You know, you have Antonio Maceo in Cuba and Gregorio Luperón in the Dominican Republic. And these are men who people look toward to take on the political mantle. And at different points, both of them just kind of retreat and say, you know what? Better not me, better someone else. And that's very much about they know that as Black men, if they, you know, took on too much or what was perceived as too much political power, that could really undermine the entire movement for independence. And it had nothing to do with their ability or their ambitions, but it had everything to do with a hostile environment. So the first thing I wanted to do is I just wanted to make us really aware of the historical context of the 19th century and how difficult it was to make a case for a country like the Dominican Republic to be an independent, sovereign, free nation. And once we are aware then of the historical context, then I wanted to say, okay, so let's look there. Okay, let's look at what they're saying and what they advocate for. And I found in Bono and Luperón in particular, they're very fully aware that Dominicans are who they are. They're white, they're Black, they're in between, and a lot of more in between than not. And they say, and this is a Hispanic nation, we're culturally Hispanic, therefore we speak Spanish, we're Catholic, you know, they sort of give a list of what makes Dominicans, what in their minds made Dominicans quote unquote worthy, right, of inclusion among the international order of states. And they also, and Luperón in particular, sees the Dominican Republic as playing this very important and pivotal role in helping independence movements elsewhere. So at this time, he's very involved in independence in Cuba. And then there's Puerto Rico that's coming online, you know, shortly in this period. And so what I see them as trying to do is actually broker a sort of nationalism that can transcend the nation, that is, connect with the independence movements in Cuba and Puerto Rico and really bring the Caribbean together. And I also see that they're, you know, somewhat limited. Like, why does this have to be Hispanic? Why does this have to be defined in ways that seem to elevate or at least you know, orient themselves around Spanish identities or Spanish, you know, cultural things, whether language or religion or what have you. So I do see where they're limited, but I also see, you know, again, given the historical context, you know, what they're trying to broker in this very hostile environment. And I also, and the third thing I wanted people to think about too, was I wanted to see them, for readers to see them in conversation with other Dominicans, but also other Haitians who are trying to think through the nation at the same time. And that's why I added Antenor Femen. It was actually one of the reviewers for my book who's made this great suggestion. And I went back and looked at some of that literature. And Antenor Femen is having, you know, these similar conversations, and he becomes part of the Pan-Antillean movement. And he gets in touch with the Hispanic-speaking complices, right, in that sense. So, you know, he's also asking questions about what is the way forward for Haiti? How can we hold on to what's exceptional about our story and yet cast that story as universal as possible? How do we open ourselves up to trade, to engagement, to interaction, but without losing who we are, and certainly without, you know, losing the material, what we fought so hard for in terms of the material resources of the nation? So these are all questions that across Hispaniola are being asked and answered. And I just wanted to put those people together because I think they were listening to each other, if not directly, certainly indirectly. And I wanted to honor that history by putting them in the same conversation.
Yeah, it's really exciting to see the continuity of and sort of the conversations that you're engaged in with people like Ann Eller and Maria Cristina Fumigali and all of the people who are sort of thinking about that island as an entire sort of a whole island and having interaction rather than always only enmity, right? It's a really exciting kind of turn in Hispaniola studies, if you will. But at the same time, and this is one of the things that's really nice about your book, is it's very rich. And you do point out that there are competing ideologies to the ones that you were just talking about and competing ideologies that were more conducive to white nationalism. So what were those and who espoused those?
So in the book, I focus on Galvan, who is really my kind of go-to person, Manuel de Jesus Galvan, who's also the author of Enriquillo, who according to Doris Sommer is sort of, you know, the foundational fiction within that genre of foundational fiction and fictions in 19th century Latin American literature. And Galvan is a really interesting person because he's clearly not necessarily optimistic that the nation, that the Dominican raza as, and I'm thinking raza in the Spanish sense of the word, not as its English equivalent race, but as the nation can really do it on its own or else. I mean, he just really, when Spain comes back and annexes the country in 1861 and then leaves, I mean, Galvan is sort of helping the Spanish government and he's very much, you know, in tune with the Spanish government and the crown and everything else. And it was really actually Teresita Martinez Vern's book, Nation and Citizen, that clued me into a possible explanation. So rather than say Galvan was anti-Black and anti-this just because he was white, or even because he may have been more royalist in his orientation, what Teresita argued was that there was really, in the 19th century national debates, there are really kind of two sides, sort of the optimistic side and a very pessimistic one. And the optimistic side include Bono, Luperón, among other people who make this argument like, yes, the nation, we can do this. And yes, we're on the forward march of progress. Galvan and others of his ilk represented a more pessimistic outlook. And one of the ways that they argued for their pessimism was to use these emerging racial and racist arguments, that the reason why the Dominican nation will fail is because there are too many people of African descent. We don't have enough whites. There isn't like a plan for, colonialism by whites, or we need a stronger power, whether it be Spain or Britain or the United States, to help us because our raza, our people, are insufficient in and of themselves. So for me, Galvan represents that sort of pessimistic outlook in the sense that he doesn't believe that the Dominican raza as a nation, as a people, are a nation yet, and that they could sustain their independence or sovereignty without the help of either another empire or without the influx of white immigrants to put the nation on the best course. Whereas Bono and Luperón, for instance, did not hold that idea at all. They were much more optimistic and they combated, or they used, as the pessimists use in their argument, a kind of racialist argument to make the opposite point, that our mixedness makes us even better equipped to face this future, to be the nation and to succeed as one. It actually is not a detriment to us.
So after you set the stage kind of ideologically, you move into this future that they're all talking about. And one of the things that happens in that future is the increased presence of the United States, right? And you argue that that changed not just economic structures, but also social and political structures in a place like San Pedro. And also that it was a regional transformation. And I thought that was really a very useful way to think about one of the results of the incursion of the U.S. into these places. So can you talk a little bit more about who gained power and who lost power in those processes?
So, yes. So that would be mostly in chapter two. And that for me was actually one of my favorite chapters to write and to write for the dissertation, but also to reimagine for the book, because it was a chapter where I wanted to include the conversation around peasant rebellion, but I wasn't quite sure how I was going to do that yet. And it wasn't really until the last moment that that really congealed for me. So yes, the incorporation, I use this idea of incorporation that actually comes out of US history in this chapter. And that's the idea that the sort of what becomes kind of a corporate industrial model at the end of the 19th century into the early 20th century not only happens in the United States, but really becomes a global phenomenon because of U.S. market incursions into places like the entire Caribbean and circum-Caribbean region, and certainly the Dominican Republic. And if we were to think of incorporation as a global phenomenon and not just about U.S. companies kind of adopting this different kind of culture and with it certain expectations around masculinity or behavior and certain, you know, protocol and appropriateness of decorum. But if we think of it as in this global context, then that helps us kind of understand there for some of the changes we see on the ground in places where the United States presence really increases. And what's tricky about San Pedro de Macorís, and this takes me back to where I started as someone interested in enclaves, is that San Pedro is not a one company town. It's not like the Banana Zone and United, you know, Fruit Company along Central America. It's, you know, you have all of these sugar estates and they're owned by different boards. And some of them aren't even owned by U.S. boards either, not at least initially. You know, some of them are, they come with Cuban money. Some of them are quote unquote Italian, but, you know, Italian via Cuba. Some of them are from Puerto Rico, and then some are based in the United States. So, but eventually most of them will become U.S. owned sugar companies and corporations. So the idea of incorporation couldn't just be a story of, oh, here comes again the U.S. hegemon into this, you know, into the space, and here all these actors, you know, just kind of imposing themselves on all these people. It had to be, the story had to be told as a both and experience. Yes, there is a severe consolidation of sugar cultivation, growing, production that happens in the last quarter of the 19th century through the early 20th century. And at the same time, you know, local elites on the ground and also non-elite actors are navigating and brokering their own kind of responses to these changes, to this influx of money, to the influx of people, to the influx of technology, to the influx of new products and everything else. So it had to be this both and story. So the folk, so who loses power, who gains power? In the chapter, I argue that in a sense, the economic power rests with foreigners essentially and their investment boards back in the United States for the most part, in the sense that these are the people who have control over the sugar estates and land, but that the local political power stays in the hands of local elites, and it transforms from the traditional landed oligarchy to a more professional, intellectual class of people by the early 20th century. And with that shift in the local context from a local oligarchy to this sort of professional, aspiring class in the city, that transformation of power right there shapes another transformation of power, which is the exclusion of you know, militias, of these groups of organized, usually men, but sometimes women, armed, you know, groups of men in the East who had been mobilized for decades. I mean, some of them had fought in the war against Spain in 1863 to 1865. Some of them, you know, 20 years earlier had fought against, you know, Boyer's forces out of Haiti. So these folks had been mobilized for a long time and had been armed for a while. And whenever there was sort of a revolution, you know, these groups would come into play. But what happens eventually is that they become, and this is what I talk about in that chapter, they become bandits. And what I find in that transition is not so much a truth about the nature and character of those groups, but really then how the powerful began to demarcate power, that as you are no longer, you know, a legitimate political actor in this landscape, therefore you are a bandit. So we will just, you know, excise you out of this story. We will deal with revolutionaries. We will deal with armed militias who we consider revolutionaries, but we'll not deal with bandits. And so at the local level, with the transition of regional power and city power, these rural groups they find themselves on the outs, and they really have to find their way back in. And so that's what I view as that, as the violence in the East is very much about peasant groups who lost what they once had, and they're trying to find their way back in this changing circumstance.
It struck me when I was reading that one of the benefits of really sort of focusing in and going small is that you can really trace these processes in concrete terms. Were you thinking about that when you were writing and doing the research?
I was. And I was so lucky to have come across notary records to really give me a sense of the story of transformations in property. So for example, one of the gavilleros that comes out in chapter two towards the end, Rincon, you know, we know his story, you know, because he's one of these, like, you know, big bandits with a big heart, you know, kind of a Robin Hood sort of character. But it wasn't until I was able to really dig deep into those regional records, notary records, combined with other testimonies, that when I found that story of his about how he lost land, it just really kind of not just symbolized, but it just sort of brought that story to life and sort of the kind of the tragedy of his story in that sense, right? Because it's so easy to paint the bandit or the gavillero as this, as whatever figure we want them to be. Oh, they're the revolutionaries, they're the anti-imperialists, they're the this, they're the that. And at the end of the day, Rincon is a guy who really just, he wants to be able to cultivate his land and finds himself just really squeezed out. But not at the same time a victim or just defeated, and he's going to lay down and let that happen. He's fighting back. And so those kinds of that fine detail, you're absolutely right. You can't get unless you go in, and it takes things like notary records, surveys, you know, those testimonies that you find in other government documents, city council records, to really give you to really get access to some of those stories.
I do sense the imprint of Rebecca Scott here on this research.
Yes. I cannot deny it. I cannot deny it. She may deny all of us, but I cannot deny that about her. She's absolutely all over this.
Well, it yields a great deal. So I think that's good. So in one of the following chapters, you talk about the ways that elites went about making whiteness in this changing context. And here again, you have another set of sources, including things like clubs and associations and organizations and those kinds of things. So what did they do, and what's your sense of why they were doing this?
So to answer that question, you may have to remember the question. You may have to remind me of the question later. Let me talk about what it was like to do research. I lived in San Pedro de Macorís for over a year. And for that, I have everything to thank Frank Moyapons for driving me to San Pedro one morning, beautiful morning, and introducing me to Dr. Fermin Alvarez, who was sort of this, he's a cardiologist, and he's a history buff and had written books about San Pedro history and had also been a president of the Ateneo. And so So in other words, the people who first gave me access to San Pedro history were all people who were in these clubs. So I you know, was able to do the history I was able to do precisely by plugging into these organizational structures. So I have those two to thank. And being in San Pedro and talking to Fermin Alvarez, Jorge Hasim, who was alive at that time, Miguel Phipps, Nadal Walcott, Margarita, I'm forgetting her last name, but there was a whole group of people who began to meet while I was there to talk about San Pedro's very diverse ethnic history and how they could, you know, contribute to a book that was eventually published in San Pedro about that history. So part of why this chapter exists has everything to do with what I lived when I was doing research in the town, and the importance that associational life had in the city then when I was doing research, and also in the earlier period. I didn't know what the story was yet, but I knew it was very key. So I just had to say that because it was I benefited a great deal from the associational life of San Pedro, not to mention the fact that also another thing that I did, I became very active in the local Episcopal church, which then gave me access to some of the Afro-Antillean history of the town as well, which we'll get to a little bit later. So I actually think that this is, since the book has been out a few years and, you know, people have reviewed it and, you know, there, it's been kind of, you know, in the discussion for a little bit, I almost think that this is one of the points that people miss in the book is this conversation around whiteness. And I don't know if it's because maybe I didn't convince people, maybe I'm not persuasive enough, maybe it was kind of hidden. But I think that one of the new ideas I bring to this conversation of Dominican race and nation, it's because it's often about why Dominicans hate themselves and why aren't they Black? Why aren't they Black? It's always about this Blackness context. And I thought, well, because it's not about, yes, it is about anti-Blackness, but it's really about defining whiteness and who's in on these principles of who counts as white and what whiteness is. So when I came to that idea and then asked the question, well, can I prove that? I went back to the sources on San Pedro's associational life and then sort of dug into that and to look at, you know, how they did things in the city. And that's where I drew upon, oh my gosh, for this chapter, city council records. Thank goodness. I mean, San Pedro Macorís is probably one of the few Dominican towns, and I hope there are more, I hope I'm wrong, that have preserved their city council records from the first city council meeting, you know, until the present. So I could trace a lot of, you know, just the ideas and the ideas that they were able to achieve and ideas that weren't so good and they weren't able to achieve, you know, throughout time and over a long period of time. And I realized a couple of things. I realized that one, I felt like this was a group of people who were very invested in a notion of civilization, in a notion of making the nation, in the idea of progress. And I didn't want to take that as just, oh, that's just being elites. They took it very seriously. And they considered themselves as a vanguard in that sense. And that idea that they were this vanguard for creating the foundation upon which a nation could actually take shape was all related to Eugenio María de Hostos, the Puerto Rican intellectual, and his idea of mora social, because it's, you cannot have the greater Pan-Antillean Confederation if the nation itself is not prepared, is not ready for that. So they very much felt that their work was in line with preparing the people for this greater things, whether it was Dominican nationhood, sovereignty, but also Caribbean sovereignty. So they really took that to heart. And they were guided by these principles out of Hostos. And they had all these different clubs. And what I realized was, well, they had the Spanish club, they had the Puerto Rican club, they had the Italian club. And I was sort of struck by, well, what was the common conversation? Like, how did these very different groups of people – at the end of the day have these, you know, juegos floriales? How did they, you know, organize these kind of unifying events? Like, what became the lingua franca? What became, you know, the foundation for their relationships? And it was the Ostos idea on the one hand, and the same time, the other argument in this book, it was that this is that, you know, Hispanic cultural values and the elevation of these values and, you know, plugging yourself into Europeanness was also this kind of way that these various groups of differently situated foreign elites, local elites, could actually find the common ground to talk across their differences. Had I had it to do it over again, however, I would have also paid more attention to family and family dynamics. Because again, in these conversations that I had while I was doing the research, and I would take notes but not really pay attention, and I wish I really had, a lot of our conversations would revolve around, oh, well, you know, so-and-so who's married to that person. Okay, well, she's the cousin of, you know, and I got these whole genealogies from people. And I realized that folks had started to marry in very early on in this process. And I wish I could have, you know, traced some of those marriages and the creation of families alongside this associational culture to really show how this is, what we're talking about is an integration of these groups of people into what would become like the city's, you know, elite, intellectual elites, economic elites, political elites, and what provides them sort of a language to come across all these other divides is the elevation of everything European. And then in addition to that, you know, eventually their families become one. But I didn't talk about the families in the chapter, but if I could do it over again, I would certainly include that, because that was clearly important. So that's what this chapter is really about, is sort of what facilitated these various groups of people to talk to each other. And I said, well, it seemed like they all got together around, you know, elevating things European, elevating things Hispanic, and then acting upon these, you know, assumptions. All right, let's talk about that.
Yeah. And then at the same time, the other side of it, right? So you suggest that San Pedro did have some Haitian migrant workers, but that there were many more Afro-Antillean migrant workers. And if you look at the map, that makes total sense, because it's sort of more on the eastern part of the island. So there are people from Barbados, St. Kitts, St. Thomas, Puerto Rico, et cetera, et cetera. So what difference did that make to the way that race and blackness were produced in San Pedro?
So the assumption in the historiography is that it's almost as though, you know, Haitians come into the Dominican Republic and it's already bad because they're Haitians, right? That, you know, such is the strength of anti-Black Haitianism, anti-Blackness and anti-Haitianism, that Haitians walk into the DR and they're already going to be set up for failure and attack. So in other words, there's none of this sort of, like, as in the literature in the US, like how Italians became white or how Greeks became white. Like, how do people become Black, right? How do Haitians or Afro-Antillians become Black or marked as such in these Hispanic locations, right? And so that was one thing that struck me. And I thought, well, And so the difference is that Afro-Antillians, they have recourse. You know, they have these consul officials and representatives that who aren't often their best people to go to, but they do have them, and it matters that they have them. And another thing, their access to English, their ability to speak English, even if they don't get the best representation from British consular officers, they are sometimes well represented and advocated for by English-speaking sugar estate managers who, you know, really who like their particular group of Afro-Antillean workers. So right there, I felt, well, the difference is going to be we can't make the assumption that, you know, Afro-Antillians coming into the space are already degraded by the fact that they're in this space, right? That by the fact that they're working on sugar estates, because in fact, yes, a ton of them do cut cane, but a lot of them have these upper level positions where they're engineers and some of them are mid managers and some of them are working in the offices and some of them work in people's homes. So it's not the same kind of story. So we have to actually explain how it is and why it is that they get picked on. Right? How that they, that their experience, that why they experience the violence that they experience. We cannot make the assumption that they land here and, you know, they're the degraded worker. So I really wanted to try to write a story where we don't presume that, that it's, you know, it's blackness upon arrival. I actually wanted to talk about its creation.
I like that.
Yeah. Right. Thank you, Tom Guglielmo. But yeah.
So you close with a chapter on gender and you make a point of saying it's understood not as separate from the race-making process, but very much part of it. So what led you to the exploration of gender? Was there a set of sources in particular or how did you decide to end up there?
So again, a lot of the sources came from the city council minutes that as I got into the 20th century, I kept seeing this woman pop up in the sources, Dr. Evangelina Rodriguez. And I was like, what is she doing? And she's, you know, fussing with the city council. The city council actually sponsors her study in France. So she graduates high school in San Pedro de Macorís, and then she wants to go to France to get her medical degree. And the city council, when it can, actually pays for her medical school. I don't know if it pays for it in total, but it helps her out with a scholarship. She returns to San Pedro de Macorís, and then she is on the city council, like just about, I mean, so many city council minutes. Oh, here comes Evangelina. She wants money for this. She wants money for that. She wants to build a school. She wants to, you know, do a clinic. She wants to have a fair in the park, what have you. And I said, huh, I really need to understand her. And then I need to figure out, is she like plugged in with other women? And so that led me to investigate her connections with other women in the city, which then revealed, and also Dr. Fermin Alvarez has a book about the first 100 years of education in San Pedro de Macorís. And so I found her to be part of a whole generation of women who were the sort of second generation to be trained after Salome Ureña's school in Santo Domingo, from that idea into the 20th century to be educators and to be social activists and to, you know, take on the world, so to speak. So I was really intrigued by that. And San Pedro also has this unique character in that the church wasn't really, at least I didn't really see a lot of evidence of like priests, like the Catholic priests coming in and imposing their ideas. It was a pretty secular kind of place. And so I felt that, of course, feminism would thrive here because it actually had a space to grow. So given the significance of Evangelina's work in San Pedro, which connected me back to her own sort of education history, which connected me back to Salome, which then connected me to Petronila Angelica Gomez, the editor of Femina, the founder and editor of Femina, I felt like, oh, there's a story here about female activism and feminism also grappling with these same questions. And I guess I was intrigued by it that way. And then as a feminist scholar, for me, the personal is political, right? So the kind of political developments and questions of the state are inextricably connected with questions of women's activism, women's movement, and women in general, sort of the woman question in general. And so I came into it thinking to myself and presuming that these women are making theory. These women are, they're theorizing and forwarding an understanding of the state and of the nation in their work. They're completely grounded in Ostos ideology. So let's, you know, track what they do. And so that's what turned me on to them.
So before we close, just a couple more questions. So you end up in 1940, and I'm wondering why you chose to end there and what happens to the DR afterwards in terms of the legacies of the kinds of things that you looked at in your book.
Yeah, so I ended in 1940 because I did not want to write a book about the Trujillo. I did not want to write a book about General Rafael Trujillo's dictatorship and add to that historiography because I really wanted to write about this particular moment. For me, it was just so foundational. And so after 1930, General Rafael Trujillo comes to power. And then after the 40s, I think one of the most significant changes, because he will stay into power until 1961. But after, in the 1940s, there's just so much. One of the significant changes is that, Trujillo will pay off the Dominican Republic's debt to the United States. He will march ahead on with industrialization of the country, really adopting what we in Latin American studies call ISI, import substitution industrialization. This is partly a war measure because of World War II, but it's also, I think, where he's thinking conceptually. He'll engage reforms for the Dominican peasantry, and he'll also take over the sugar production and make that a state enterprise with his family as, mostly the shareholders in that state enterprise. So a lot changes after 1940 that I felt that I could not, that would be an entirely different book or, kind of like, oh, in part two, here's this really different kind of story. So a lot changes there. So what I just try to suggest in this study that some of those, like the foundations of some of those changes, especially with respect to how we think about state-driven development and the nation all at the same time, really has its origins in this period.
Yeah. So before we close, one last question. What are you working on right now? Are you working on a new project?
Yeah. So I we're actually in how do you call this? In press. yes, in press. Yeah, so as you were saying about the development of this sort of Hispaniola type of perspective in the scholarship, so from 2000 and 2009 and 2010, myself and several colleagues began the first in a series of conferences called Transnational Hispaniola, with precisely the idea of bringing Dominicanist scholars and Haitianist scholars together in conversation to think about, can we do this differently? And can we get out of the sort of exceptionalist narratives of both of our countries and talk across the island as opposed to just talking to the US, right? From our very different perspectives. So since 2010, we've had three of those conferences, the first one in Santo Domingo, the second one at Rutgers University, and the third one was in Haiti, just most recently, in 20, I'm now forgetting 20, the last time CSA was in Haiti, so that's 2016, I believe. And so we are now publishing the edited volume. Yay, Transnational Hispaniola, New Directions in Haitian and Dominican Studies. That is in press at University of Florida Press. And so we just sent back copy edits and we'll get proofs in February. And so that will be out next year.
That's fantastic. I will really look forward to that.
Yes. I look forward to it too.
Thanks so much for talking to me, April.
Thank you, Alejandra. It's been a pleasure.
Bye.
Bye-bye.